Okay, so how many people actually were not here yesterday? Welcome. And is anybody new to a London Insight event? Great. Is anybody new to meditation practice altogether? Okay, great. So the topic of our coming together is compassion. And I want to especially talk about compassion in connection to a couple of other qualities. It's a bundle taken together of qualities. Is known as the four Brahma Viharas in Pali, Pali being the language of the original Buddhist texts. Brahma is often translated as supreme or celestial. A translation I've heard of it that I like quite a lot is best. Vihara means dwelling or abiding or home. So taken together, these four qualities are said to form our best home. And like any home, we may not be there all of the time, certainly, but we know what it feels like when we get back there. It should be the place where we feel most relaxed, most authentic, least pretentious, or home. So these four qualities are said to form our best home. The first is loving kindness. The second is compassion. The third quality is this quality called sympathetic joy, actually taking delight in the happiness of others rather than seeing someone's success or good fortune and falling sway to the voice which so often arises within us that says, ew, I wish you had a little bit less going for you. You don't have to lose everything, but if the light could just dim a bit, I'd feel better about things. So sympathetic joy is the opposite of that, where we actually take delight in someone else's happiness. And then the fourth quality after loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy is this quality of equanimity. In this context of the four Brahma Viharas, equanimity means balance. It's the balance that's born of wisdom. It's like perspective. So we'll talk particularly today about really all four of them and the way compassion works in this context. How it works with sympathetic joy, how it works with equanimity, and also some about how it works with loving kindness, which is kind of like the vehicle often for all four together. But to begin with, why don't we do a sitting, which I'll guide you through. We'll do what is really often the foundational aspect, even though other methods get built on top of this. This is like the fundamental skills training of meditation, okay? So you can sit comfortably, see if your back can be straight without being strained or overarched. You can close your eyes or not, however you feel most at ease. If your eyes are open, they could be a little bit open. You can find a spot to rest your gaze, let it go. We can start just by listening to sound, whether it's the sound of my voice or sounds in the room, sounds outside. It's a way of relaxing deep inside, allowing our experience to come and go. Even though, of course, we like certain sounds and we don't like others. we don't have to chase after them to hold on or push away. Just let them come, let them go. It's like the sounds just wash through you. And bring your attention to the feeling of your body sitting, whatever sensations you discover. Bring your attention to your hands. See if you can make the switch from a more conceptual level to the world of direct sensation. Noticing pulsing, throbbing, pressure. You don't need to name these things, but feel them. And then bring your attention to the feeling of your breath. Just the normal, natural breath. You don't have to try to make it deeper or different. See if there's a place where the breath seems strongest to you. Maybe it's at the nostrils or the chest or the abdomen. You can find that place, bring your attention there, and just rest. See if you can feel one breath. You don't have to be concerned with what's already gone by. You don't need to lean forward for even the very next breath, just this one. And if you like, you can use a quiet mental notation of in, out, or rising, falling to help support the awareness of the breath, but very quiet. so that you're really feeling the breath. And if images or sounds or sensations or emotions should arise, but they're not all that strong, if you can stay connected to the feeling of the breath, just let them flow on by. You're breathing. But if something comes up with a bang, it's got some intensity to it, you get lost in thought, spun out in a fantasy, or you fall asleep, don't worry about it. We say that the most important moment of the whole practice is the moment when you realize you've been gone. That's already done with. But in that moment, where we recognize perhaps, oh, it's been quite some time since I last felt a breath, that's the moment of transformation. Because instead of judging ourselves and berating ourselves and being down on ourselves, we practice letting go gently and with kindness toward ourselves begin again. If you have to let go of some distraction and shepherd your attention back to the feeling of the breath a few billion times in the next few minutes, that's okay. No matter what happens, however far away our attention might go, we can always, always begin again. We've got the model of the four Brahma-viharas of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. Loving kindness being friendship, or another way of understanding it is a deep sense of knowing that our lives are connected, that our lives have something to do with one another. I remember once many years ago, I can't remember the year actually, but it was a while ago. It was a winter season where I got really sick. I kept getting bronchitis, and then I'd start to recover and I'd get sick again, and then I'd start to recover and then I'd get sick again. And I was finally getting better. And a friend had offered me an apartment in New York City to stay in. So I was in New York City, walking down the street one day, when I heard a woman's voice behind me say, "I've been very sick all winter." So naturally intrigued, I turned around. And there was a woman giving a whole bunch of money to this guy sitting on the sidewalk, a street person. And she said, "I've been really sick all winter. I've had pneumonia. And every time I'd start to get better, I'd have a relapse. And then I'd start to get better, and I'd have a relapse." And she said, "Now I'm really finally getting better. And I just wanted to share the joy." So she was handing him a whole bunch of money. And I thought, wow, I just walked right by that guy. I've been sick all winter too. Should I turn around and give him a whole bunch of money saying, "You're not going to believe this, but my lungs were really not that good either this winter," and, which I ended up not doing. And but the point is not whether you give the money or not, and we'll talk about that later too in terms of discernment. It's that feeling that someone's life has something to do with yours. That they're not an object. They're a being who wants to be happy just as we do. That's the bottom line. So it's that knowing. It's that felt sense that everybody matters in a way. Everybody counts. We have a connection with everybody. It doesn't mean you're going to give everybody money. It doesn't mean you're going to bring them home with you. It doesn't mean even that you're going to like them. But underneath our actions, underneath our emotions even, there is just that sensibility. Oh yeah. Compassion is the second Brahmavihara, and we're going to keep going through all these as well. Compassion is the second Brahmavihara. Rests on understanding that just as we all want to be happy, we're all vulnerable to loss, to change, that suffering exists in this world, pain exists in this world, not in equal measure by any means, but that it's a part of life and that we're all vulnerable. Doesn't mean life is bad or it's miserable, but acknowledging the pain as well as seeking the pleasure as we tend to do is a big step toward freedom, because then we can reforge our relationship to pain, to difficulty, to stress, to distress, instead of, if it's our own, feeling bad and awful and judgmental and condemning and frightened and ashamed, we can have some compassion for ourselves. If it's someone else's, we can develop compassion for them as well. So compassion is sometimes known as the trembling or the quivering of our hearts in response to seeing pain or suffering, and it's a movement toward. to see if we can be of help, of service in some way. We can't always, for sure, and that also is looked at under equanimity, but instead of going into denial or reaction or pushing away or hiding, it's the movement of our hearts that leads us toward. Sympathetic joy, as I described, is the ability to feel joy and happiness in the happiness of others. And equanimity is the balance that's born of wisdom. In many ways, equanimity underlies all of these states, because without wisdom, without that kind of perspective, they each would sort of slide into something else. Loving kindness is often talked about as a freely given gift. And we know we can give a gift in a lot of ways, right? We can give a gift freely. We can give a gift with a lot of strings attached. Like, tell me by tomorrow it's the best book you've ever read in your life. Or thank me again in a better way. There could be so many expectations or demands, and that's natural, that's human, but it's different than a freely given gift. And obviously one leads to much more frustration than the other. So it would be wisdom, it would be equanimity that would be brought to bear on a situation where maybe we see our expectations are not really going to get met in a timely fashion. Something like that. Or I'll introduce this other model, which fits in here, and we'll see where the two models come together. And that other model has to do with action, where it could be said that anything we do, anything we say, has these three aspects. The first is the motivation or the intention that's sparking the action. You know, so I might reach out and pick up this vase of flowers and hand it to you, to one of you. And all anybody sees is my hand moving down, picking up an object, and moving it forward. But what's the heart space that's generating that? What's moving me to do that? Maybe I'm offering it to you because I like you and I want you to have it. Or maybe I see you've got that really cool looking shawl and I think, huh, here's a calculation. Maybe I'll give you this vase of flowers and you'll give me that shawl. How great is that? Or maybe I don't like you and I suspect you're quite allergic to something in there. So I pick it up and it's the same smile, right? It's the same look, but coming from a completely different place inside me. So from the point of view, say, of Buddhist psychology, that motivation, that intention is a very, very significant part of the action. As we talked about some yesterday, it can be really different here in the West. It could be more like, what do you mean you had a good intention? Look at how you messed up. Or the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But in this other psychology, the intention is really crucial, because that's what distinguishes one action from what on the surface looks completely identical, but is coming from a totally different place. So we use mindfulness to be more and more in touch with our intention. It's almost like saying to yourself in the beginning of a conversation, what do I actually want most out of this conversation? That's a doorway into knowing our intention. Do I want to be helpful? Do I want to be harmful? Do I want to be seen as right? Do I want to explore an issue with an open mind? It could be anything, really. But what do we want? That shows us, in many ways, what our intention or motivation is. So that's the first part of an action. And mindfulness does bring us closer to knowing where we're coming from and anything we do or say. And it's said that the cultivation of qualities like loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy will transfigure our field of motivation. If, for example, we've largely been coming from a place of fear in what we do or what we say, and we cultivate loving-kindness and compassion, we will find that we are more and more coming from a place of connection. That's what is sparking our actions more and more. So the second part of an action is, we might call it the skillful or unskillful execution of it. And that would imply discernment, mindfulness in a bigger context. I sometimes call it our best guess of what the most skillful thing to do or say is. So maybe I want, out of a beautiful motive, to give someone this vase of flowers. And I stop and think, well, you know, there are a lot of people in this room. There's only one vase. Maybe this is best done privately. Maybe I should take you aside and make the offering. So certainly this is also a realm where we continue to learn and grow. We might learn skills of communication, all kinds of skills. We learn from our mistakes. We learn from feedback. You know, last time you hurled that vase of flowers at me across the room wasn't a good thing. Like, oh, don't do it that way, right? Something like that. So it's like discernment, it's understanding, it's sometimes bringing hard-won wisdom to bear, it's remembering, and it's learning skills. And then the third aspect of an action is the immediate result. I talked about it a little bit yesterday in terms of the immediacy part. Maybe I give you this vase of flowers. I'm coming from a really good place, I have a really good motive, I'm doing it in the best way I can assess it be done. And maybe just before you came in here, you picked up your cell phone messages and you found out you won $10 million in the lottery, or however much that would be here. You won a lot of money in a lottery. And you could not care less about these flowers. You're thinking about the florist shop you're going to open and the chain of them and how they're going to go international. So I hand you this vase of flowers and you sort of nod distantly and walk away. That's the place we need equanimity. We need balance. We need wisdom. Because it's quite rare that in that moment of disappointment or frustration, we think, or maybe they have something going on right now. More likely we think, I'm so stupid. How could I always choose such bad flowers? Look at that. I should have known they didn't like orange. Why didn't I know that somehow? Could have given that other bunch of flowers. Why didn't I do that? I'm so bad. I'm so awful, right? That's more common than just having some perspective. So equanimity is perspective. It doesn't mean we don't care. Of course, as human beings, we would like to be thanked. We would like to be appreciated. But we can also have the understanding that life doesn't always give us exactly what we want. And that ultimately we're not in control of the unfolding of events. We can and should do absolutely the best that we can and keep learning. But there's just not going to be a time when it's all so perfect that everybody is going to react uniformly in acclaim of what we said or did or wrote. It's just not like that. It's too bad, really. I think it would be a much nicer world if I was in control, I think. But I'm not. So equanimity doesn't mean flatness or indifference. There's some poignancy in there too. Like, wow, wish I could make it so, and I can't. So ultimately there's that acknowledgement and there's some measure of peace, because we're not fighting against how things are. So these two models fit together in some very interesting ways. It's important to be able to make a distinction, say, between our motivation and the skillful execution of an action, especially when we're looking at a quality like compassion. Because so many times people think, well, if I were to be coming from a loving or compassionate place, I could only give away all my money, let them move in with me, keep smiling, say yes, whatever notion we might have, and it doesn't mean that. Those are two different things. We might genuinely, authentically be coming from a very compassionate place, and our best guess of the most appropriate way to act in a certain moment, in a certain context, is being pretty fierce, being quite intense, saying no, not letting them move into our apartment, whatever it might be. And this is just important to understand as a framework as we continue to explore the nature of compassion. It doesn't mean giving in. It's not being weak. It doesn't mean you're going to say yes to everything. It doesn't mean you turn into a doormat. It means that we can be coming from a better place, motivated by qualities that are more true, more open, more open-minded, see more possibility, and so on. So we're going to keep looking at that, those two together, the four Brahmaviharas and the three aspects of an action. So do you want to do some walking meditation? I'm always thinking about the rain. But once again, I have an umbrella, so it probably won't rain. And this time I have a shawl, unlike yesterday, so we can expect the temperature to go way up, which is really good. For those of you who've never done walking meditation before, I'll describe it. And of course, there are many ways of doing walking meditation, so you can experiment with different forms. Some schools actually have one do walking also resting the attention on the feeling of the breath. That's not the way I learned, so it's not the way I teach. But if that's what you're used to, certainly, you know, it's fine. It's good. The way that I was taught and the way I teach is more that instead of resting our attention on the feeling of the breath while walking, we have a very light awareness on the sensations of our bodies in movement. So right now, sitting here, see if you can just tune in to, say, your feet on the ground. Eyes open. So as your eyes are open, you're aware of everything around you, you're listening, maybe you're thinking, should I go to the bathroom first, whatever. You can just, not in a tight, hunkered down way, but you can just keep coming back to feeling your feet against the ground. Right? That's basically the essence of walking. And as I said yesterday, if you don't actually want to do walking as walking, it's fine. You can apply the same principles of mindfulness in action to anything, making a cup of tea, for example, which you might want to. I was once on a train from London to Devon, and the announcement came over the loudspeaker, "If you require cream tea, please come to the dining car." And Joseph Goldstein and I were sitting there thinking, who requires a cream tea? You may want one, but is it really required? Anyway, whatever you do, and I'll describe it in terms of walking, but understand that the really identical principles apply in any activity. We want to be lightly resting our attention on something that is actually happening in the moment. In walking, it's the feeling of your body in movement. It may be your feet touching the ground. It may be your body moving through space. That's the resting place for our attention. Eyes open. If you're outside here, I'd say walk at a normal speed. Don't scare the children. There are many ways, of course, of doing formal walking meditation where we slow down quite a lot. That is probably not really appropriate here. You can slow down a little bit, just given the constraints of the space. And just walk back and forth. Feel the breeze, feel the sun. Keep tuning into that, what we call the primary object, which may be, let's say, your feet touching the ground. And always, always, the primary skill of any kind of meditation practice is going to be the ability to begin again. Because especially being outside, all sense doors open. There's going to be the potential for a great deal of distraction. What is that tree? I want to grow one. Wait a minute. I live in New York City. I can't grow trees. I wonder if you can grow trees in Central Park. I wonder if you need a permit. Huh. How much would a permit cost? And do I have to get the cutting from London and get it all the way over to New York? Oh, that may be too expensive. Maybe I should move. Right? That will happen, very likely. And here, too, there comes the moment when we realize, oh, right, walking. And you just start over. You don't have to beat yourself up. You don't have to go on a trip. It's like, all right, distracted. Let go. Come back. Okay? Do you have any questions just about the method of doing walking meditation? Yes.